very honored to be here in this great institute to explain you this recent work we did with Ignacio, and where, in a nutshell, the objective is going to be to go from discrete tensor networks to continuous tensor network states for quantum field theory. And really, so in a discrete tensor networks, it's an object where you have like physical degrees of freedom living in some indices and auxiliary degrees of freedom living on other indices. And a question would be like, in what sense can we obtain a continuous object here in which those auxiliary indices become fields and those physical degrees of freedom becomes fields as well? And that's the things we've been trying to do with Ignacio, and for which we have a proposal which is so far a bit abstract, like not very practical for computations, but at least that gives an idea of what the object could look like. So I will motivate why you could be interested in such an object in the first place. First, the computations, like the continuum brings a lot of methods that are completely not obvious in the discrete. Some perturbative expansions are really clear in the continuum, but they have no clear equivalent in the lattice. Saddle point approximation, differential equation, all those things are methods you have in the continuum. Also, you may want to apply tensor networks method directly to quantum field theory without having to first discretize your QFT on the lattice. And the third point, which is related to the second, is that the nice thing with the continuum is you can implement spatial symmetries much better. And the last point is a bit more conjectural for me because I know much less, but given the recent interest in tensor networks and holography, you can hope that by having analogs directly in the continuum, you can implement these ideas more directly than by using a discretization. So there could be other objective, other reasons for constructing this continuous object. I'm open to any application there could be. The following is going to be sort of an introduction for why tensor networks are interesting. I take the risk of being far too fast if you have no idea what it is, and a bit insulting for the experts in the room who actually know much more about discrete tensor networks than I do. But the idea, or at least the way I understand it, is that many body states are complicated. You have exponentially many parameters to parameterize the wave function, say, of a spin chain. This object here, like you have 2 to the n complex parameters to write the state of a spin chain with n spins. But typically, many body Hamiltonians, they are very simple. So if they are typically a sum of quasi-local terms, so you have constant times n, and even the number of parameters is more or less constant if you consider only translation invariant Hamiltonian. So the space, the states in the whole exponentially large space of states, the space of interesting states is much, much smaller than what your super complicated parameterization allows you to reach. And so if you want to do variational optimization to find a ground state, you would typically like to have a subspace of the Hilbert space that is good, in that it is quite close to the ground state. It's not too expensive, you don't have exponentially many parameters, but a bit less, say either constant or polynomial, and that your subspace approximates well interesting states. And it's even a bonus if local observables are easy to compute. That's not always the case, even for tensor networks. And an example, maybe this is an idea, and you don't have to use tensor networks to do that. In many other fields, this is used. For example, mean field approximation can be seen as choosing a very small subset of the state of space. In quantum chemistry also, there is a huge industry of ansatz, of different variational wave functions you can use. It can seem the same way as trying to parameterize a subspace that is close to the subspace of interesting states. For those who are interested in the quantum Hall effect, the Moore-Reed wave functions are a typical kind of ansatz of wave functions that tries to capture the properties of the ground state. But say even more broadly, the neural networks used in machine learning and the subset of neural networks that are convolutional neural networks can be seen as variational ansatz that are restricted in that they don't get everything, but they are sort of tailored to the to the geometry you're interested in. So, and for our spin chain that we started with, a good on that that is used in the literature is that of matrix product states. So here, perhaps, I don't know, is everyone who is not familiar with matrix product states? Who is not? Okay, so probably okay, you know the definition of matrix product state, then I will keep on. There is probably not much need to say more. So let me go directly to the notation that we use for matrix product states, where you have here in blue, my convention is where the physical degrees of freedom live, and in orange, where the bond in the bond degrees of freedom live. And you can and say that the state is parameterized by choosing these tensors, and the dimension of the orange indices quantify the amount of entanglement that there is in your state. And for example, if you want to compute the correlation functions, say a two-point function of local observables, you can do that by iterating a transfer matrix. And so you see that it's a rather simple problem, compute expectation values in the setup of the matrix product state. And you see that the contraction for computing an expectation value for a 1D system in that case can be seen as an open system dynamics, because this object can be taken to be a completely positive map in D equals zero. So that's sometimes why people, just to warn you of some uses of the word orthography in this field, people sometimes even call that like the dimensional reduction of like the holographic feature of matrix product states. But say that's not, that's quite different from the sort of holography you get with MERA. And once you have this graphical representation, then basically you can write all the tensors in that are used typically. So the projected entangled pair states are the 2D generalization of the MPS, where you have as many blue physical indices as you have auxiliary indices, but you can also put the physical indices only on the boundary here. And then, of course, if you choose special tensor here, you get what is called the MERA. And my objective will be to generalize this object. But once you can construct a continuous version of this object, it's pretty easy to find, at least to guess what would be a definition for an object like that in the continuum. Okay, a list of brief characteristics that make tensor networks nice in general is that basically the first is very trivial, is that tensor networks that cover the whole Hilbert space when you make the bond dimension big. Yeah, this is not very useful in practice, because that's the very thing you're trying to avoid, but it's at least good to know that you can get everything. They have an area law of entanglement entropy, which is what gives you the intuition that they are going to be good, because they verify a property that many ground states verify. And numerically, they are very efficient in 1D for quantum systems in 1D. Another interest is that they can implement symmetry very efficiently. And a nice thing also is that they have an associated parent Hamiltonian. So instead of studying the space, instead of giving yourself a Hamiltonian and looking at its ground state, which is a difficult operation, you can generate states, which are tensor network states, of which you know there is a local Hamiltonian, and this way study phases starting from the state instead of starting from the Hamiltonian. And what are, then we can start to split, say, in success and limits of this approach. So it's very good for 1D, arbitrary precision, basically. Good for classification of phases. It allows progress on non-abelian lattice gauge theories, because you can define easily gauge invariant states. And it has provided nice ADS-CFP toy models. On the other hand, it is very hard to contract in more than one dimension. So the nice thing I showed with transfer matrix, the fact that you can compute an expectation value by iterating products of matrices, no longer is valid in more than one dimension. And then you have approximate algorithms that in some cases are good, but cannot even as a matter of principle be arbitrarily good in general. You have no continuum limit also in more than two dimensions, at least so far. There is the PEPs before our work. There was no, I would say, very convincing quantum field theory version. And this point is related to the first, is that if you have no continuum, it's harder to have analytic techniques. And so, okay, can we go beyond that? And that is the main objective of my talk, is to give you, explain this proposal we have. And for that matter, let me explain first how you get the continuum limit for matrix product states, because this is well known, or at least this is known since 2010 on a paper by Verstraete and Sirac. So to have an intuition of what the continuous matrix product state object would look like, you can start by blocking in your matrix product state 2x2. You just block, you don't do any then decimation, any remove, you don't remove excess degrees of freedom, you just block. Because a limiting object, if you want a continuum theory, is gonna be this blocked stuff. And what happens is that, and it's quite important, you see that the bond dimension is fixed. There is still only one orange line going through this block here. So it means as you go to the UV, to the IR, sorry, that you block stuff, your bond dimension doesn't increase in 1D. But the local physical dimensions, of course, explodes. And that's why you go from spins to, say, fields. Okay? And very intuitively, this huge tensor products of C2 is going to become a field. And heuristically, it's sort of the central limit theorem. But, and so at the end of the day, and I don't really care so much about the exact form that a continuous matrix product state takes, but a continuous matrix product state is a quantum field state that is still parameterized by finite dimensional matrices, because they are the objects, what parameterizes the states lives in the bond index space. And so there are these two matrices here, which are the equivalent of the A matrix for regular matrix product states. And basically, the difficulty was trying to find the same thing for tensor network states more generally, that is, having an object that takes a tensor with a finite bond dimension and associates a quantum field theory state to this. And in a way, this is what we think should be relaxed. Because if you look, so this was the situation for a matrix product state. Let's say now we try to do the same thing, get the same intuition for a PEPS, so for the same object in 2D. We block by 4, but we just do pure blocking. In the same way, the physical Hilbert space increases, and that's not surprising. We're going to get a field theory on the good continuum object is going to be a field theory on the physical degrees of freedom. But you see that the bond dimension increases too. There are also more degrees of freedom in the bond space. And this is something you cannot see if you stay in one dimension. And so this is why we go directly to say that here we should also have fields living on these bond indices, and that there is probably, or that is sort of the heuristics we have, that there is probably no good definition of a continuous tensor networks in more than 1D, where you keep discrete tensors locally. But still, we will see that we can still reach a discrete parameterization by essentially giving parameterizing the action that these auxiliary fields are going to have. And this parameterization of the action also can also take the form of matrices and tensors, but there is no longer, the fundamental object is clearly an object acting on fields. Okay, so now if you want to define some continuum limit, you really need to expand your tensor in some trivial part plus corrections. By trivial part, I mean a part that is going to create zero particle on the vacuum, okay, plus epsilon correction that are going to make the state non-trivial. And this is exactly how it goes for continuous matrix product states, where to define a continuum limit, you take this matrix, your elementary tensor, as the identity acting trivially on the vacuum, plus epsilon correction terms And if you do this, sorry, it gives you a state of this form with a path ordered exponential. So this is this procedure you want to generalize for if you are, say, in 2D. And so there are many, many options to do this, because there are many tensors that could be good candidates for being the identity in more than one dimension. You could like connect all legs in a big delta, so that's equivalent to taking a GHD state. But this actually, it's quite easy to understand why it's going to be the case, but you can see it at the very end of the day. At the very end, I will go back to this, but at that point, let's just accept it, that it yields a trivial geometry if you start from this. Like, there is no good way to obtain a continuum limit with new length scales if you take this as a starting point. Something that was taken in the literature before us was to take the identity, but in one direction. Okay, so basically your elementary tensor is going to be a map that is the identity for on the two sides of the indices. But of course, if you make such a choice, this is the choice that is the closest to the matrix product state in spirit, but you break a rotation invariant because you have a preferred direction in the Euclidean plane. But you could say, okay, but let's take instead the sum of the two identities and the two possible directions. The issue in that case is that you'll get loop diagrams like this when you do the tensor contraction. And these loop diagrams, this is going to give you the trace of the identity. But as we said that we wanted an infinite bound dimension, it gives you the trace of the identity in a space of infinite dimensions, so you get divergences everywhere. And we didn't really know how to deal with this. So in the end, the only thing we managed to do to get a continuum limit, so that doesn't mean it's a unique way, but I want to argue that it's a natural way to get it, is to get a soft version of a delta. So instead of taking a delta, something forcing the indices to be the same, you take something that forces the indices to be very close instead. OK, because the indices we have are going to be continuous, because we are going to work in infinite bound dimension. And so our candidate for a trivial tensor is to take an object of this form, where on each, the indices now are really fields living in, say, real numbers, but say in RD. So instead of being 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, D, the indices are D real numbers. And you take as elementary tensor just the sum of the square of the differences between the indices, between next neighbor indices. So you see that it's something that takes only significant values when the indices are close to each other. So this is really a discretized, this is really a smoothed, a modified version of the GHD state on continuous indices. Okay, and then you add a local correction to this tensor in the form of a local potential, plus another function of the field creating an excitation in the physical space. This operator here is the creation operator for the physical degrees of freedom. These fields are the auxiliary, so the bound degrees of freedom. And you add this correction so that now your tensor is this object times this object. So it's really an object acting on fields that are auxiliary fields, creating a state in the physical space. And then you realize that if you do the tensor contraction of a network of these objects, you get a functional integral. And this trivial tensor here gives you the massless free field measure. Okay, so that's the intuition for how you get the continuous object. And this leads to a definition for the continuous tensor network, which really is the continuum limit of this procedure when epsilon goes to zero of this form. That is now a physical state. So a state on the blue indices here is now the path integral over auxiliary fields of a certain functional of those fields times, and then a correction here, which is a, say here it could be phi square or a function of phi times the creation operator. And that is, so you see, these are all numbers, except this guy that's an operator acting on the physical vacuum. So this object is a state living in the physical Hilbert space here. So here, like here, we take like bosonic commutation relations. Okay, that's only the first. That's only the first step because I'm a bit cheating in that this object is not really a state. It still has indices in the in the auxiliary degrees of freedom, so it's not a state. It's still a big tensor. But then you put a boundary tensor to make this object really a state in the physical Hilbert space. And this is just equivalent to adding a functional of the field, of the auxiliary field, only on the boundary. So at the end, you have, if you have a discrete tensor network, it has physical indices, auxiliary indices, and a boundary tensor. And in the continuum version, you have a state corresponding to the physical indices. You have auxiliary indices, which are classical fields integrated over in a path integral. And you have a certain boundary function of those fields, which is equivalent to this boundary tensor in the discrete. That sort of give the intuition, the intuitive mapping between the discrete picture and the continuum picture. So in the same way as before, I showed you that you can really see say, for example, the MPS as an iteration of a map in an auxiliary in one direction. In the same way, you can this PEPS tensor network, you can roll it over one dimension and see it as a map being iterated in this dimension. And you have really exactly the equivalent representation for the continuous tensor network state. And this is exactly like when in quantum field theory, you go from the path integral representation to the operator representation. So this expression is just totally equivalent to the previous one. If you insert resolutions of the identity in the field basis, integrate over the momenta. So here you have the field, phi and pi rk, conjugated pairs of auxiliary field living in one dimension less. It's like in QFT. Now you have a QFT in the auxiliary space, this direction. Okay, so there are two equivalent representation. Okay, in the same way here, you have to put a boundary conditions that transform, that kill the free indices here, and that's putting in the same way a matrix here. So here it's this matrix is an operator acting in the same space as those fields here.
So when you, can you go backwards slide?
Yes, more like this?
Yeah. Yeah. So if I would discretize now the field instead of having some real numbers only accountable many.
Yes.
And then how would I get the PEPS back from that, the bond dimension of the PEPS? So is there any relation between discretizing the field instead of discretize these values that the field can take? You have d fields, right?
Yeah.
Each of these fields, d
You take a single field, so to simplify
that
the
that
will already give you PEPS, yeah.
Okay.
So if you discretize the field, and you have to also rediscretize space, that would give you a field.
Yes. This d that you call the bond dimension, and so your bond dimension in your case is the number of different fields you have.
Yes, so it's a priori not related to the usual bond, just chi, the bond dimension chi.
All right.
It turns out that in some places it seems to behave in the same way, because it sort of parametrizes the complexity that you can put in the bonds, but the thing is, the continuum is so flexible that even with a single field, by taking a horrible potential here, you can already reproduce everything. So the thing is, it's already very expressive with a single auxiliary field.
So you wouldn't pay for it.
The question is, if you now limit these, okay, now this the tensor is really an object that two functions associates a state. And if you put constraints on this function, say you expand them in polynomials of the field, you get discrete parameters. And if you want to reduce, say, this object to be at most quartic, then you have much more expressivity by having many fields. An example is if you take this object quadratic so that it creates a Gaussian state, you have many more Gaussian states if you allow for many fields, many auxiliary fields.
Okay. But even for d equal to 1.
Yes.
So d equal to 1 would give you basically be the closest analog for to the discrete peps, if you would discretize it.
No, I think it, I mean, I don't know which one is the closest. They will all give peps. So they are all the continuum limit of a peps, and they are, would all give a peps upon discretization.
But it's not always clear how. Okay.
No. No. Really, this carries through if you take many fields or just one. It's basically you just want your indices to have a continuous part, but then you can they could be vectors or carry an extra index. Yeah.
Related question: have you thought about how the continuum limit might work if you also went from, say, a discretization of these real-valued fields to a continuum in the field values at the same time as taking the continuum?
That I don't know. So, yeah, really, you're right. It's always simpler when you want to make a theory continuous in space to start already with stuff that is continuous in the bounds, but you could say what you say also start with a finite bound dimension that is discretizing in the bound dimension space.
Yeah,
that would probably be doable too.
You don't have a proposal for that?
No. You would probably have to be quite careful in the way you take everything to infinity, say, and that you get something that is sufficiently close to a differential operator in the limit. And that I don't know, I must say.
Yeah.
Yes.
It also related somehow to entanglement entry.
In what? So.
The D.
Yeah. So that's a good question, and the simple answer is that I don't know, and what we should do, and this is sort of the next step, is make analytic computations in the Gaussian case. So as we will see, there is a if here V is at most quadratic in the field, and here it's at most linear. You get a Gaussian state, so you can, in principle, compute everything. And to see in that case how the entanglement entropy behaves for a typical if you increase d, but that we haven't done so far. That we would expect that it's the case, but I don't know. Yes.
I think this is already sort of an ask, but I quite kind of bounced off me. So I see you've made a definition of, I guess, some object that lives in this blue continuous.
Yes.
Then I see on the left there's a peps and then there's an arrow. So has the arrow been justified at some point? Why should this definition be connected?
Basically, it's equivalent to taking, if you take this epsilon, so which could be A, your lattice spacing, to zero, this is really, now you get this object.
So it's not a definition. I guess I'm confused. How can it be a definition and also a limit of something else?
No, it's a limit, but now I say this is the definition of a continuous of what I call a continuous tensor network that lives in the continuum.
So that would be obtained.
But that could be obtained by the continuum limit of something.
You're calling that limit a continuous.
Yes, yeah. Gotcha. It's just that you could have an object that is defined only as the limit of something. Okay, that happens quite often. In that case, the object can already be defined in the continuum. Actually, in the paper, we do the opposite. We give, this is a definition, and OC, it could be obtained by the continuum limit taken appropriately. And actually, when you do computations in practice, you forget completely about the discretization. You can, this object is manageable in the continuum already.
So you could call it anything. So it's nice to call it continuous tensor network, because it isn't, as a matter of fact, really.
Yeah.
Just forget about that fact.
Yeah, totally. No, I think this is the as we will see, the drawback of this proposal so far is many aspects are quite formal, but the very positive aspect is that it is a genuine continuum limit of a tensor network. There is no analytic continuation or no heuristics to say this should be how it looks like.
Okay. Well, I guess what this means is that you might also be able to make some statements about the properties of the states based on the properties of discrete tensor networks.
Yeah, but that's, you see, for example, the property, that's true, but if you look at typical quantities you would like to relate to the discrete, like entanglement entropy, in that case, it's not so trivial because it's always argument that it's upper bounded by the bound dimensions. But once you start to scale it as well, you would have to control how the limit goes to exploit results we know about discrete PEPs and entanglement entropy.
Right.
Yes. So my feeling is that for entanglement entropy, it might be interesting because it's different and also perhaps easier to look at simple states for which we have analytical control in the continuum already and look at, take inspiration from the computation that I've been made for free field theories, for example. There was a question. I mean, it's clearly the most important part. Now it's a definition, then I will give some properties, but the core of the thing is, what is this object? Yes. Yeah.
Was the limit only for bosonic fields, or is it?
Okay, so it looks all nice for bosonic fields, and so we presented and we wrote things for bosonic fields. The issue for the path integral representation, if you start to have fermionic fields, is that you need here an object that is going to be a Grassmann even, but here it's going to be a Grassmann odd time your creation. It doesn't look so nice as a fermionic path integral. Of course, you could write it in the operator way, where you will have perhaps an easier definition. I'd say just we haven't, because it was the picture was so much simpler for bosons, we did it mostly for bosons. But for fermions, I expect things would work sort of in the same way, but with the a slightly obfuscated path integral that would be a bit more difficult to picture. If it's all right, I'll keep on. I guess this is a lot of notation. I mean, it's an object that looks probably quite weird at first sight, and then you get a bit used to it. You use the computation, and you see it's a bit more practical than it looks. First, an object you can try to compute, maybe. If this looks a bit abstract to you, is if you have a generic state in Fock space, so this is what we are trying to construct, actually. We are trying to construct states of quantum fields, so states in Fock space here. You can expand it in wave function, in n-particle wave function. And if you look at, this is like phi, this is the same as here. You can write this wave function in the path integral representation and in the operator representation. And what you notice in both cases, so I give a notation here, but essentially you realize that the n particle wave function is given as the n point function of alpha of phi. If you look at this object alpha of phi here, or in the picture here, when you look at the n particle wave function, it's equal to the n point function of this alpha operators. This is the same, this is true both in the functional integral representation, of course, and in the operator representation. So it's really, it really looks a lot like the Moore-Reed wave functions when you define wave function as correlators of the CFT. Except here it's a correlator of a field theory, yet of the auxiliary field theory you want to specify. So that's a connection with these types of wave function. And actually this defines the state. So you can define the state that I gave you as well as giving all its n particle wave function and saying that all the n particle wave function are given by n point functions of this field alpha. That provides an equivalent definition. Although it makes the link with tensor networks perhaps less clear once you write it this way. Now some properties. So the first question you can ask is, how big are these continuous tensor network states? It could be that they are like Moore-Reed wave functions, that they are very good in some cases, but that they, even as a matter of principle, cannot extend to the whole Hilbert space. A bit like a bit like product states, which can be good in some situation, but that you know in general cannot approximate everything. So what you can see is that the sum of two tensor network states is still a tensor network state with increased number of fields in that case. And because you can, because with no auxiliary fields, it's exactly a coherent state, a field coherent state, you can write any sum of field coherent states as a continuous tensor network state with a sufficiently high bound dimension. And this ensures that in principle, you can approximate any field, any state in the Fock space with a continuous tensor network state. Again, that doesn't mean it's good. It could be a horrible approximation. It's not, but this is just showing that as a, in principle, by increasing the bound dimension, you could, the number of fields, you could get closer to the real, to a given ground state. As I mentioned before, even for d equal 1, even if you give yourself only one auxiliary field, you can take a weird potential so that you get everything. But the you have much more flexibility if you allow for many auxiliary fields. And we're going to see also why just after. This slide is probably not so fundamental, but it's... The message of this slide is that you can, in the same way, you can compute correlation functions in the physical space, and they are given by a generating functional that can be computed by either by Gaussian integration in the functional integral representation or using Wieck theorem in the operator representation. And it's a bit like for a continuous matrix product state, you have a transfer matrix that you evolve, and then you insert operators that have this form. I made a mistake, it's alpha here, sorry. And you get your endpoint function this way. So this is extremely similar to what happens for continuous tensor networks, except that now the operators, they live in one dimension less, but one dimension less now is not zero. One dimension less is d minus one, so that's one in dimension two already. So you can compute expectation value for a physical state in D dimension by doing an open system evolution in D minus one of an open field theory in D minus one. Another interesting property of discrete tensor network is that they have, if you take this a tensor and you have a U and U minus one tensor, and another U, V and V minus one tensor, these two tensors, they generate the same state up to boundary conditions, correct? Because if you transform this to this, they are all gonna cancel inside and just remain outside this conjugation. And a good question is, what is the equivalent in the continuum of this property that there is sometimes called gauge redundancy in the definition? And interestingly, so what you do is, again, you take this in the discrete and you take the continuum limit in the same way we took it to define the tensor, and you get that this continuum redundancy is equivalent to adding a pure divergence term to the potential. And thanks to Stokes' theorem, a pure divergence term is integrated into a boundary term. So you understand a bit geometrically from that the equivalent of this transformation is adding the divergence of a vector field, and that this gives a boundary. So in the continuum, it's just Stokes' theorem, this this gauge transformation. Of course, here we don't know and if we get everything. It's possible that there are more transformations that keep the state intact and that we just didn't see them. Well, the only thing we tried to see is if we could find some. And that's actually an interesting open question to know what exactly is the redundancy of this parameterization of the state. A nice, and it's probably a nice property, so of these objects is the renormalization. Here, renormalization is really understood is the sense of scaling, not in the sense of integrating modes. And you give yourself a certain correlation function at a certain scale, and this is given by for a certain tensor network state, and you want to know can you write this correlation function? Can you, as if it were this one, but for a different state, okay? So basically, can you flow the state from one scale to another? Can you see how your state looks like at different scales? And this, I mean, it's just, it's doable exactly. You just do the transformation into the path integral, and it all goes to the auxiliary fields. And you realize that your potential V, if you do this scale transformation, is just a lambda d V of lambda minus, 2 minus d over 2 times the position, and the same for alpha. And that gives you what powers of the field in V on alpha yield relevant or marginal couplings in this picture. And the interesting thing is that because you are, your auxiliary field theory lives in the same number of dimension as your physical field theory, you get many more interesting possible interactions than you would get in the standard picture of QFT, where you go from where quantum field theory in d plus one dimension is associated to a Euclidean statistical field theory in one dimension more. So here you have that the dimension of the auxiliary field, so of this classical random field, is really the same as your physical dimension. So you have much more freedom in these powers. For example, in d equal two dimension, if you have a continuous PEPS, you have as many powers that are going to give interesting field theories as you like. Okay, that's also a drawback, because it means that the natural scaling, the natural decay of correlation functions we will have, if we don't tune properly the parameters, are going to be those of the wrong dimension if we are trying to do relativistic field theory with this. And probably if you want to go do relativistic field theory in this framework, you would need to add an extra auxiliary dimension, a bit like you do in the mirror, to get the correct decay behavior. Okay, you can go back to a CMPS. Okay, like we were trying to generalize PEPs, so showing we get continuum limit for tensor networks. It's also nice to see that people had managed to construct continuous tensor networks in 1D, so try to at least see if we can get back in the 1D limit what they see. So you take D minus one dimension, but you compactify them, and you take them with a very, very small radius, so that now you have a tube that is your equivalent to your one-dimensional CMPS. And it gives you an object of this form, where this is just the momentum operator for a particle, and here the position operator. So we went from a field theory Hilbert space to the Hilbert space of quantum particles in D space dimension. But it's still infinite. It's still L2, basically, this space. But if you take deep minima in a continuous space, you effectively get a discrete degrees of freedom. And the Hamiltonian makes you do tunneling between those deep minima. So if you take a special V that has deep minima, the field, auxiliary field here, can only take discrete possibilities, and you get back, you get back exactly the CMPS. So it's more of a generalization of the CMPS that in a certain limit, when you scale things properly, gives you back the CMPS. And of course there is no natural version of this if you go to more dimensions. Because you could expect that by doing this, now that I have my thing with infinite bound dimension, I could try to do the same and rediscretize the values of the field. And there is no equivalent in more than one dimension of this procedure. Finally, once you try to do it for Euclidean invariant, we fought hard to get rotation invariant, Euclidean invariant, but now we can break it. And it's easy to add more complexities in the definition and say that now we allow for anisotropies and that we allow for metrics. and put the CM, the continuous tensor network, on whatever manifold you like. So that comes at basically zero cost. Why would you do that? Because then you have an interesting possibility, which is to the operator that is going to create fields in the physical space, you can localize it only on the boundary. And then you can take an hyperbolic metric in the bulk. And then your C-mera is going to look like this. It's going to give an object, it's a discrete mera. It's going to become an object like this, where you have the auxiliary field living here connected to this field on the boundary. And it looks very, very much like the C-mera in D-1 dimension. Although we cannot prove it's exactly the same so far. There is clearly a picture that is quite appealing once you make this generalization and allow the operator to be localized on the boundary. Okay, so this is something that would be I think quite interesting to study in the future, is how these continuous tensor networks look when the physical field is restricted on the on the boundary of manifold. I think there are also many, I should probably mention like the important limitations of the approach so far. What makes it quite abstract is that you can compute everything in the Gaussian regime. So if the functions we take, if the action we take for the auxiliary field is sufficiently simple. But after you reach the same problem as in quantum field theory, it's not like you can miraculously compute everything for interacting theories. It's limited to bosonic field theories, as I said so far. Like it's not so, we didn't work out the computation in the fermionic case. It would be interesting to know if they have a parent Hamiltonian, if you can find easily a Hamiltonian of which these states are ground state. There is a lot of activity to construct gauge invariant state for PEPs. It would be nice to see if in that case it can also be done, but straight from the continuum. Also, an interesting aspect is the topology and the fact that now that the state no longer lives on a lattice, you can really put it on whatever surface with a weird topology without caring about can this sphere be tiled by some network. And then you can add terms in the action, say like Chern-Simons action, or terms in the auxiliary field that see the difference between various manifolds, the topology of different manifolds. That's something also to explore in the future, I think. So let me conclude by giving you this summary and thanking you for your attention.
If you would like to have a state that is non-Gaussian,
yes,
then choose which one was it, the alpha?
So in this, it means that V, if it's more than quadratic, you won't be Gaussian. So for example, if you have phi cube, phi 4, and here alpha, if it's more than linear, so if you have alpha equals phi square, this object is already non-Gaussian because the partition function is quadratic in alpha.
So if you would like to do something like a variational calculation, do you approach that?
Yeah, so if you are, again, in the Gaussian case, if your state is Gaussian, it's pretty easy. Yeah, I mean, in the non-Gaussian case, you will have to do something like, you would have to do, say, perturbation expansions, or you would get back to these objects. The nice thing is that the state itself is a priori.
You mean perturbation expansion about a Gaussian point?
Yeah. So say you imagine that it's quadratic plus a small parameter, and you expand. The nice thing is that the state is a priori defined formally this way, and what you will expand are correlation functions or observables of this field. The hope also is that, say, the scaling behavior or things like that, you could extract exactly. Or say, just look at how does this state look in the infrared. This is just like a field redefinition. So it's easy to flow this state. But I agree that if you want to do variational optimization out of the Gaussian case, you have to either rediscretize do perturbation expansions or more or less fancy perturbation expansions. Or another option is that in 2D, to compute correlation functions, it goes back, as I said, to iterating a transfer matrix in one dimension less. And so if you have sufficiently good control of your numerics for 1D quantum field theories via CMPS, you could bootstrap the thing and numerically simulate it to compute the correlation function of the one above. Yeah. But that's, of course, only for 2D. Because of the fact that to contract in D equal 2, you need to solve an open system evolution for a QFT in D equal 1 physical dimension, something you could hope that you have a sufficiently good control over with the CMPS algorithm. Question?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. What is the regularity class of phi that you're integrating over?
You mean, so you're saying in terms of random fields?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a regularity of the random field, of the free random field in D number of dimensions. So a good point is, a priori, things you will compute with this, you can run into divergences so long as D is more or equal than 2. The thing is, actually, so the divergent behavior is slightly better because you have one less dimension than usual. So you have a QFT in D space dimension. Now you get the divergence only of D instead of having the one of D plus 1. And it turns out that for some quantities, for example, if you look at the particle density for a Gaussian case, you have a cancellation Poli-Villars style. So you have a 1 over p squared plus m squared minus another 1 over p squared plus m squared. So the leading order divergence cancels, and you get finite quantities. But that I don't understand very well. But in, say, for this to make sense, say, in 3D, probably you would have to, say, to put a regulator lambda here that breaks locality a little bit, and then scale it and take it to the limit. It turns out that, surprisingly, in some cases, you don't even have to, because superficial divergences cancel each other.
Maybe there's a way to prove when that happens, right? Like, what are the necessary conditions for divergences to cancel?
That's a good question, and that I don't know. That's clearly an important question.
Also, I'm a little bit concerned about that B over there.
Yes.
That enforces the boundary condition. Right?
Yes.
So, for example, if you impose Dirichlet boundary conditions around the boundary, that B would presumably be the Dirac delta, right?
Yeah, yeah, okay. You mean it's written a bit too fuzzily? Yeah, that's what I have in mind. I would say, if I were taking Dirichlet boundary condition, I would say remove this B and just say integrate with Dirichlet boundary condition. I'm not saying I would impose it with a functional.
Wondering, like, are they equivalent, right? If you put a Dirac delta, and if you restrict the space in which you're integrating over, are those two things equivalent?
Are you meaning, like, rigorously, mathematically, is there... No, so you have to be careful that... I mean, in practice, again, none of those things are going to be on very sure footing mathematically, so you will do what's convenient. So here I would impose a Dirichlet boundary condition. Now, but of course you have to be okay. The free field measure in 2D, it's already very, very hard to define rigorously mathematically. And it's true that once you put boundary condition, you no longer have a Radon-Nikodym derivative with respect to the one without boundary condition. So what I'm doing here is not very rigorous, but that's always what we do in QFT. So here I'm saying, I'm writing it in a way, and then in practice, to be rigorous, you would probably have to change a bit the way I wrote it. I stayed a bit in what is usually done in QFT, where you accept that it's even the same. If you put a 5-4, you're no longer perturbing around in a meaningful way, but we still do it, okay? So you imagine there is sufficient regularization in everything so that it's meaningful. I guess.
It's not really, would you be able to build a numerical ansatz out of this definition? It's not totally clear to me how that would work.
And you could, that was probably numerically, that would be probably extremely inefficient, but that you could in principle encode is do a brute force Monte Carlo of by sampling over the auxiliary field. Yeah. So you write a correlation. So here you can just write realizations, okay? For each realization of the field, this thing is a coherent state, so you can compute everything. And so you just sum over realization of the field phi. Okay, you really see this as a random field phi. You generate one random realization with Metropolis Hastings. And you look at the generated state. You generate many, and then you compute expectation value with that. That's extremely poor. But
that's even sillier. So I guess that's one technique you could use to optimize it.
Yeah.
Suppose even just given a state, what would I actually put in my
computer? No, that's what I would do for given a state.
That's not defined a particular state.
If you give a particular state, how would I compute observables? I thought that was a question you asked.
No, I just want to know what goes into my computer to represent one of these states.
The parameterization of V. So for example, it's true that V is a function, but you can typically you will expand it as a polynomial. Say it's going to be some VI phi I1 plus something quadratic.
What is
phi?
Is it a scalar?
Phi is the auxiliary field you are going to be integrating over. No, these are the parameters. Yeah, so you have, what I'm saying is instead of having a tensor, you have a vector, a matrix, a tensor with string indices, but you would cut it at some...
And you would have to truncate at some
rank. Exactly, and you would truncate at... and that's why you see that if you restrict yourself to a finite degree, which is probably what would make sense in practice, say you want to stay Gaussian to look at a subset where you can do things exactly at the first step. In that case, you have much, much more freedom, much more parameters if you allow many fields, because instead of having two scalars, you have a vector plus a matrix, and this matrix is as large as you have fields. So
everything about different states of the same theory is just values of V, is that correct?
Yes. So if you have, you give yourself a V, it gives a state. The state is really something V alpha, and you can, if you can parameterize those functions by in an economical way like this, you have discrete parameters.
And then you would have to resort to the definition to make actual computations for expectation values and so forth.
Yeah, but actually, so as I gave before, they are, if you look at correlation functions, you have integrated versions that no longer show the. Where is that? But you have things that are a little bit more practical. I didn't write this expression, but you would compute this generating functional of the endpoint functions. So you can convince yourself that if you differentiate its object with respect to J and J prime, it gives you the correlation functions of the physical field. And this object has a slightly nicer form than the state itself.
I'm sorry to keep going. So the complexity of the representation then is a function of when you can truncate V at a given accuracy.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
It's not clear to me why you would expect that to ever truncate. Why should V truncate?
It's for everything. If you you truncate because you want the why should it be good with finite bond dimension? It's a bit the same question.
Because of the area law, you're putting with area law states for that. Is there something a comparable result for complexity of?
Yeah, so that's the question. What we hope is that regardless of how far you go, what matters is the number of fields you put for typical values of V. Okay. But that is a conjecture so far. We don't really know. Again, it's a bit more difficult to make computation in that case. And if you want to have area-low things, it's more difficult because the usual upper bounding arguments don't no longer work. Do you want to start?
Thank you. You say something about what kind of state can in principle be generated given that your different choices of BI and
I mean, if you truncate to a certain order, what can you in principle reach?
Yes.
No, I don't know. So a case where it's pretty clear is if V goes like this and alpha of phi is up to linear, okay, so then you know you can only get Gaussian states. So it clearly you don't have everything. Yeah. More generally, I don't know what you could get. It's possible, for example, that with just a small nonlinearity getting you away from Gaussian states, by fine-tuning everything, that would be sufficient to get everything, or maybe not. You know, that I don't know. I don't know. Yes?
So is the state UV regularized?
Sorry?
Does the state have a UV regularized?
So that's a bit the question from before. What is dominating the divergence is clearly the behavior of this field and the fact that the one-point function, whether or not they are divergent. So you're a bit better than in the usual case when you do a Euclidean field theory because you have one dimension less, so it diverges a bit, not as bad. But in dimension two, it's true that this theory is already divergent. You already have log divergence of two-point functions. It turns out that when you compute particle densities for a simple state, the divergence cancels out, and this object is finite. But I don't know if it's always the case. Say, to be safe, in three dimensions, for example, you would this is probably a very formal expression that would give infinites, and you would have to cut the momenta of phi to make something finite.
But for example, particle density is finite in some cases.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that particle density is finite in some cases, even though the underlying field theory looks auxiliary theory looks divergent because you have the cancellation.
So, what, in which cases is it finite, and in which is it not? Does it depend on what, which, other you if you change the parameterization, let's say in d equal to 2, you would get.
No, but this is, okay, this is what I'm saying. It cancels is for a specific example that is Gaussian. And you expect that once you put phi 4 everywhere, it's going to blow up like in the standard thing. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the answer for every question you ask on the theory, if you put phi 4, is infinite. You have to put regulators. When I write formula like that, I do a bit like everyone does in QFT. You know, you write expressions that are a priori meaningless, but you expect that, okay, in practice, you would put a cutoff lambda that schemes the momenta. The thing is, it's not so bad is that if here you start killing very high momenta, penalizing them very strongly, you are going to break the locality of the theory. So it means that it no longer corresponds to a tensor network that has this strong locality condition. But maybe the discrete equivalent would be tensor networks that go a bit further away. But you still have a state. Even if you regularize like crazy this field, you still construct a state. That's quite important because usually when you regularize a quantum field theory, you no longer have a quantum field theory. Okay, like you break the Hilbert space when you regularize in Euclidean space. So at least here, if you do regularization, it looks less worrying. The object still makes sense, is what I mean. You lose the parallel with the discrete. It's no longer the continuum limit of a tensor network, but it's still a legitimate state.
And one more question. Is it important that could you have a compact field as well? Or does that change?
No, that's a good point. I don't know. You see that the nice thing with the Gaussian wave function is that, this term is that they go well to the limit. So you would need something that that goes well to the limit. So say you're thinking about some
field, I don't know. Like
some like engage theories, for example. Like
that's just a field that doesn't take values between minus infinity and plus infinity, but only between 0 and 2 pi, for example. Something like this. The field's fine.
Yeah, no, that I understand. But usually in the continuum limit, you're going to look at the field just around some small value, and it's going to be continuous again. I don't know, Arzef, do you have in mind continuous field theories where this stuff happens?
Compactly supported fields?
Compactly valued.
Instead of having values, the field cannot take values, any arbitrary real values, but only values mod some number.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, so it's finite, non-zero, only in a compact interval, right?
Yeah.
So usually that changes your regularity class. That usually improves your convergence.
Yeah.
Question?